Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. First, the needs remain very real in the areas of eastern Kentucky that were hit hard in late July by the most catastrophic flash flood anybody can remember, mostly in the counties of Letcher, Knott, Perry, and Breathitt, where Jackson correspondent Crystal Jones heard from Genevieve Neese, family resource coordinator at Sebastian Elementary School.
Now, the repairs will be extensive. Right now, I have families that cannot find sheetrock. I have several families that lived in double-wide trailers and in single-wide trailers, which is the number one housing option here. And the rain comes so quickly, if it didn't wash it away and break it in half and let it float down the river, their roofs are leaking, their walls are leaking, their windows are leaking. They can't even find roof coat. Roof coat is a major need. Think of a 14 by 70 trailer. One bucket is 5 gallons. It costs like at least $150. You would need 5 gallons, if not more, 5 buckets, 25 gallon, to cover the roof good, to keep it from leaking.
That's Genevieve Neese talking with Crystal Jones in Jackson. Donna Daniels with the Brushy Fork Institute has an ongoing survey running in the region.
We asked, what do you need the most right now? And we asked them to select 5 items off of a list. And the ones that rose to the top of the list, which won't be surprising because of what we just heard about housing, is housing repairs. And, for example, those are things like we need new drywall, we need new flooring, we need mold remediation, and those types of things. Second on the list was appliances, washers and dryers, refrigerators, stoves. HVAC and heating is third on the list. As our weather gets colder, I think, you know, that's going to become more and more of an issue. And so those were really by far the top 3 items that were listed. And then you get into household things like beds and mattresses and bedding and sheets and kitchen and bathroom and that kind of thing.
A link to contact information for long-term recovery groups in Breathitt, Letcher, Knott, and Perry counties is posted to the top of our homepage at esweku.org. Cash contributions are being accepted and managed by the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, and there's a link to the foundation site as well. In 2018, the Kentucky State Legislature passed the Ann Klein and Fred Gross Holocaust Education Act. It requires that Holocaust education be taught in all Kentucky middle and high schools. University of Kentucky professors Janice Fernheimer and Karen Petrone are leading a new initiative to train educators across the state in Holocaust education. And they are Gerald Smith's guests for this latest in our series on racial justice and equality in America.
Dr. Janice W. Fernheimer is a Zanker Charitable Foundation Professor of Jewish Studies, Professor of Writing, Rhetoric, and Digital Studies, and James B. Beam Institute for Kentucky Spirits Faculty Fellow at the University of Kentucky. She directed the UK Interdisciplinary Program in Jewish Studies from 2012 to 2022, and she also received the College of Arts and Science Award for Diversity and Inclusion for its programmatic impact in 2019. She is the author of Stepping into Zion, Hatzid Harishon, Black Jews, and the Remaking of Jewish Identity. She's also the co-editor, along with Michael Bernard Denals, of Jewish Rhetorics, History, Theory, Practice. She created the Jewish Kentucky Oral History Project in 2015 and received the 2020 Midwest Archives Conference President's Award for her work. She regularly teaches courses about the Holocaust at UK, as well as courses on Jewish graphic narrative and representations of Israel, Palestine, and comics. Dr. Karen Petrone is professor of history at the University of Kentucky and the inaugural director of the Cooperative for the Humanities and Social Sciences in the College of Arts and Sciences. She is the author of Life Has Become More Joyous, Comrades, Celebrations in the Time of Stalin, and also the author of The Great War in Russian Memory. She is currently at work on a book on war memory in Putin's Russia. She has been a member of the Jewish Studies faculty at the University of Kentucky since 2009 and has taught about the Holocaust in a UK core course that she co-designed on war and society, 1914 to 1945. Professors Fernheimer and Petrone, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you so much for having us. We're really delighted to be here. Thank you so much. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here.
Dr. Fernheimer, what is the Holocaust K-12 Education Initiative? How did it begin, and how is it actually funded?
The UK JHF Holocaust Education Initiative is a project that we started working on probably long before it actually became funded, but it is a project in its heart to work collaboratively with teachers across the Commonwealth to help them feel better prepared and ready to engage in state-legislated Holocaust education, which is mandated at the middle school and high school levels all across Kentucky. How it began, for many years, we've been wanting to get involved with this project since the legislation was passed in the year 2018. The work on this particular initiative began in earnest in the spring, Dr. Patron, the spring of 2021, is that right, when we first started meeting?
Yeah, that's right.
Where we had a wonderful opportunity to meet with local educators in Fayette County Public Schools and with some representatives from the Jewish community facilitated by the Jewish Federation of the Bluegrass, and to begin to discuss how we might use the expertise of faculty at the University of Kentucky to work with teachers to help develop curriculum that could be used in classrooms. And it is funded with a grant from the Jewish Heritage Fund to support the curricular development that we're doing, the training sessions that we're doing with teachers, and also the curricular development that the teachers are then doing after they participate in the training sessions. So we did two initial trainings last year to kind of pilot the program. One happened at the University of Kentucky in October, where we worked with our colleagues in education, and we did a training session with students in the master's and certification program and students who were learning in the programs, preparing them to become middle school educators in Kentucky. And we did another session last January with our colleagues in Fayette County Public Schools. And at each of those, more than 20, I think there was like 40 teachers in the fall and another almost 30 in the spring, worked together with faculty to take on the hard questions of how do you educate about the Holocaust in a way that is engaging for students, but also gets at the big questions in the small time pockets that are allowed in the curriculum.
Dr. Patron, so how are the educators recruited and how are they actually trained to teach about the Holocaust?
So one of the things that we discovered after our pilot programs was that we really from the beginning, from the ground up, we invited Fayette County teachers to work with us to create those pilot programs. And we realized one of the things that we really want to do is have teachers working with us every step of the way, being collaborative with teachers. And so what we did in the spring of 2022 was recruit a class of teacher leaders. So these are 20 teachers who already have some experience teaching Holocaust across the state. And we invited them to become our partners and to work with us to develop workshops for other teachers. And all we did was we put out a call to all of the school districts across the state, and we had 42 applications for 20 slots, and they were all excellent. So we had even more demand than we could fill in this first class of teacher leaders. And now we're working with those teachers who are in turn going to recruit their peers for an additional set of workshops that we're organizing in spring of 2023. There's going to be the opportunity for teachers all across the state to sign up for 11 workshops that are scheduled in the spring. And of those 11 workshops, I believe it's 6 online and 5 in person. So that means that these workshops are accessible to every teacher in the entire state. And the only requirement is that you be a middle school or high school teacher in the state of Kentucky.
Okay. So what is the goal of this project?
Well, the grand goal really is to create a network of Holocaust educators across the state. We do have funding now from a Jewish Heritage Fund, and we're requesting an extension of our grant so that we can train even more teachers. We'd love to be able to train another couple groups of teacher leaders and more, you know, maybe another several hundred teachers to get to the goal of training 1,000 teachers. But with the help of the Jewish Heritage Fund, what the idea is to create these networks so that they can go by themselves afterward, right? In other words, to establish them so that educators already are working with each other on Holocaust education, and it's Holocaust and genocide education, and talking about how to deal with these difficult topics in the classroom. And that we are going to create sort of networks of educators who will then be prepared to do it and do this into the future. We're also developing a website of lesson plans geared to Kentucky curricula. And those ideally too will be available into the future. So we want to set it up so that we have an enormous amount of expertise and resources for the teachers in this state to teach Holocaust education into the future.
Well, several months ago, Whoopi Goldberg, host of The View, was suspended for 2 weeks because she said the Holocaust was not about race, but, quote, man's inhumanity to man. She later apologized. But how do you respond to persons who still hold to this understanding of the Holocaust?
Well, I think it's important for us to take a minute to understand or to show how Goldberg's remarks really demonstrate the importance and necessity for an educational initiative like the one that we've got off the ground here. If a well-respected celebrity doesn't know and fully understand the way that race figures in Nazi discourse about Jews, we have a lot of important educational work ahead of us. Her initial remarks show a lack of understanding about the ways that language works to racialize people as others. And of course, in Nazi discourse about Jews and Jewish people, they were racialized as first an inferior other and then dehumanized to be not even human. And those steps in the way that language works to dehumanize groups of people make it then later possible for them to do truly horrific things. And I think that's part of what she was getting at about the inhumanity to other people. But her remarks reflect this general not understanding how race figured in the way that Nazis talked about Jews and conceived about them. And of course, the Nazis borrowed the way they talked about race from American race theory. And that's a really interesting and complicated rabbit hole that we can get into. Mm-hmm. But I think the important thing is to emphasize how her remarks show that this kind of additional education is really important and necessary, even for someone of her status and stature.
So, Dr. Pichon, just to follow up with that comment, do you believe your project is relevant to teaching about racial justice and equality in America?
Absolutely. Because one of the things that we're doing is trying to help students understand how this horrific thing could happen. How could it be that one group of people in society could not only oppress others, but ultimately encourage the entire population to allow for these people to be killed? And the Holocaust is one example of the ways in which othering and racializing can lead to violence. And so by exploring it and exploring it in the context of other genocides and of other violence that's produced by racial othering and by dehumanizing people because of their differences, we can really shed light not just on the Holocaust, but on these processes that produce human violence, and especially where race is used to separate people, to divide people, and then to define certain people as inferior others, and then to harm them. So I think that that is something that is really a universal question, and we can really think about how to promote racial justice by telling the story of the Holocaust and understanding that millions of ordinary German citizens did not protest or complain when their neighbors were being othered, were being pushed away, were being thrown out of their jobs, were being removed from their houses, and eventually taken to concentration camps and killed. But the moment at which the society could have stood up and said, hey, this is unjust, this is wrong, was lost. And I think that's part of the story of the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Fernheimer, what do you say to persons who may view the Holocaust K-12 initiative as simply just a dimension of critical race theory at work in the classroom? And Dr. Pichon, I'll give you a chance to respond to that question as well.
Well, I think this kind of conflates things that aren't the same. So I think we hear a lot about critical race theory in the media right now in a way that's really divorced from what critical race theory actually is and where it appears. And it's being used as a kind of red herring to call attention away from the really important and necessary work of asking these kinds of hard questions, like Dr. Pichon mentioned, like how could something like this happen, which requires us to go into the history of how race operates in a society and how the language and process of othering comes about. It doesn't just happen overnight, right? There are many steps to that process. And so when we use critical race theory conflated in this wrong way, right? Critical race theory at its heart is a very specific legal discourse that Dr. Crenshaw coined and uses in really important ways. But this is not what's happening in the K-12 classroom. What's happening in the K-12 classroom, what needs to be happening, is the attention to the difficult questions that involve race. And I think that's the conflation that's happening. That's something that this really important work where we need to get into how people become othered and what are the histories at work there and how that happens is being mislabeled as critical race theory. And I think the important thing for us to remember is that all that red herring attention puts teachers and classrooms in a hot seat in a way that doesn't make it conducive to better education if they're under the microscope in that way. We've seen that in some of the responses to our training that teachers are feeling really uncomfortable about how to broach these really challenging and difficult and necessary questions that come along with how did the Holocaust happen? And that's part of where this initiative comes in, is to help teachers feel prepared and confident in their leading of very difficult questions about how the Holocaust happened and why it's important for students to understand, so that we don't participate in those same kinds of processes of othering and dehumanizing others that allow for those acts of violence, small and large, to take place.
Dr. Patron, you want to give a response?
Sure. So one thing is that it's important to remember that the Holocaust education is state mandated. And, you know, in 2018, the law was passed, the Anne Klein and Fred Gross Holocaust Education Act. And so, you know, on one level, you know, sort of critical race theory or no critical race theory, this is also mandated in schools. I agree absolutely with Dr. Fernheimer that what is happening in schools is not critical race theory. That's very misleading. But it is so important for us to help teachers. One of the things that we're trying to do is to bolster teacher confidence in being able to address difficult questions. And all of the conversation about critical race theory has made teachers frightened to do this, but we're trying to help them to, you know, ask important questions in class and to, you know, sort of address, you know, these really crucial issues with confidence and with a lot of good content knowledge so that they can go in and explain, well, this is how it happened. This is what you need. And this is, you have to understand this, you know, in this particular way, because here is what happened. So giving teachers the knowledge, giving them the experience, that will help them to frame these questions in the classroom in a way that will, you know, make them and the students comfortable to deal with these questions.
All right. Well, thank you. That's UK professors Dr. Janice Fernheimer and Dr. Karen Patron. They are the co-directors of the UK Holocaust K-12 Education Initiative. I'm Gerald Smith for Eastern Standard.
Logan Jones, a partner with Middletech, is here to tell us about the Kentucky Tech Map, a tool that you can use to pitch your concept to investors. If you're not driving, you might want to log on to kytechmap.com, and follow along with this conversation. Welcome, Logan.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be here.
So tell us about the Tech Map. What is it, and how does it work?
Yeah, so I think it would be helpful just to give a little context on Middletech and why we feel we're positioned to build this tech map.
Sure, absolutely.
So Middletech is a media company, primarily a podcast and social media channels that exist to create content around startups and entrepreneurship and technology in this region. And through our work on that podcast, we've been running it for about 4 years, we just noticed that there is a disconnect between angel investors in this state and startup founders who were trying to raise capital. And on top of that, one of our presenting sponsors of the podcast, of Middletech Podcast, is KY Innovation, who is responsible for running the Angel Tax Credit Program. And we heard a lot of disconnect on that end of things as well. So the what of the Kentucky Tech Map is it's basically just an open source Wikipedia sort of page where founders can come on and build a profile for their company, just let people know that it's being built here in Kentucky.
And I've noticed that you've added a feature now. It's called Investor Connect. There's a tab up there for Investor Connect. What's that do?
Yeah, so really we wanted to simplify the process of getting angel investors connected with founders that are raising capital here in Kentucky. So the gist of the new Investor Connect feature is that a founder can go on, once they create a profile for their business on the Kentucky Tech Map, they can check that they're raising capital. That will then prompt them to upload a pitch video as well as a deck talking about their company and why they're raising capital. And then on the other side of that, we've created a portal for angel investors or investors of all types to go and create a profile, select what types of companies they're interested in investing in. And if it meets the criteria on the other end, when a founder uploads their pitch deck, it'll automatically blast that pitch deck and video out to any applicable investors that might want to invest in that company. So it just tries to bridge the gap between the two.
Well, I know, Logan, that you really come by this honestly. You're immersed in this ecosystem. You spent several years working at Awesome Inc. And helped grow the Lexington startup ecosystem. Now you're a senior account executive at Leadrilla, which is based in downtown Lexington. What's that? What's Leadrilla?
Yeah, so Leadrilla is essentially a call and lead routing platform for the insurance industry. So might seem like a kind of boring industry to be building in, but we identified a big need in an industry that was underserved by technology, built a platform to solve a problem, and we've been operating for about 4 years now. I've been the company for about 2.5 of that. So I got to come on pretty fresh out of college after my time at Awesome Inc., more as a generalist than anything and just kind of help however I could. Now we've scaled that team from, I was the fifth person to come on, now we're at 14 people with that company.
Well, a lot of this, most of it revolves around entrepreneurialism. And to be an entrepreneur, you have to be comfortable with risk. Would you say you are?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's become a personality trait for me at this point. I like risk-taking.
Well, what can you tell us about the tech scene here in Central and Eastern Kentucky, for that matter?
Yeah, I think that a lot of people don't realize how flourishing it really is in this area. I mean, when you go and really start diving into what founders are building here, there are companies that have been being built for 5-plus years that are employing, you know, 10 or more people, which is a really big deal to be able to supply those kind of jobs. You know, you can see a full list of all the companies that are being built here that we're paying attention to by just going and looking at our podcast feed on Middle Tech. But in terms of things that are going well, things that could be improved, we always ask that question on our podcast to try and get, you know, what is the state of technology and startups and entrepreneurship in Kentucky. And the answers that we get pretty consistently are the things that are going well in this region is that everyone is so collaborative and the relationships that can be built here are a reason that it's easy to be successful here. So I think that's something we should really continue to invest in. And what could be going better is access to capital. And that's a big reason why we built the Kentucky Tech Map and the Investor Connect feature is because we want to be able to provide easier access, less gatekeepers, make it just a little bit more frictionless to raise capital.
And I should mention here that occasionally we get a shortened version of those podcasts, which is always delightful, always really interesting. How about the investment climate on the other side of the equation? What's it like?
Yeah, so I definitely think it's more lacking than in other ecosystems. And I think that's more of just a cultural thing. I don't necessarily mean to critique the investors here. When you think of somewhere like Silicon Valley, it's really in the culture out there. You grow up in it. You see your parents are working at tech companies, and as a young kid, you grow up and you're immersed in that culture. Whereas here in Kentucky, it's capital flows to more traditional assets, real estate. You think of like the bourbon and horse industry that's been developed for a long time around here. So I think that's essentially the main problem with capital and investment in Kentucky is that a lot of the investors here don't think of startups and early stage companies to invest their capital into. It's more of a risk averse mindset. And that's just kind of the culture that we have built here in Kentucky. It's not necessarily a bad thing. Now that where Middle Tech comes in is trying to change that culture by talking about some of the success stories that are being built here. But as far as where it is currently, it's improving, you know, year over year. We've been running this podcast for 4 years now. And it seems like every year we see more venture capital from Kentucky being put into Kentucky companies. And I think that's a really encouraging thing. One last thing I will say on that, and this is kind of from one of Middle Tech's co-founders because he went about it in this way. I don't think it's a bad thing to think of going outside of Kentucky to bring capital back into Kentucky. And what I mean by that is if you're a Kentucky founder, don't be scared to go out to Silicon Valley and get into those networks and raise capital from a firm out there, bring it back to Kentucky and use it to employ Kentucky people and grow your company here. So that's something we've been talking a lot about at Middle Tech as well, is building inroads to other places where capital might be more abundant and, you know, not as risk averse as what it is here in Kentucky, but bringing that capital back here so that, you know, we can create a little bit more of a flywheel by building companies up, building talent up, and then hoping that there's an exit of some sort that creates more capital in the ecosystem.
Oh, that's, yeah, it's a good thought. It doesn't have to come necessarily from within the borders, does it? Well, to bring it full circle, the tech map, has it worked so far? Have connections been made that resulted in investment?
Yeah, so we've been seeing pitches get uploaded and investors connect on there. We probably need to build a feature so that we can track if the investment was actually made. Our role kind of ends once we connect the investor to the founder there. But we've been getting good feedback from the investors that we have on there in terms of, okay, this is a good way to provide deal flow. That's one of the main gripes that I think a lot of angel investors had about trying to take advantage of the tax credits is, well, there's just not much deal flow in Kentucky. And I think that's one of the main things that the Investor Connect feature is going to help solve, is now founders are uploading their pitch videos and their pitch decks, and it just makes it a lot more frictionless for these investors to have their pitches be put in front of them.
Well, let's put a mark on the calendar about 6 months down to the road, or maybe a year down the road, and see where this is then.
Absolutely. Would love to do that.
All right, Logan Jones, thank you so much for stopping by Eastern Standard.
Thanks, Tom. Really enjoyed it.
Coming up after the break, details of a rare Christmas season performance in Lexington. And our latest radio play, The United States Versus Fear.
I'm just wondering, where is my part in the death of your dream?
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
WEKU is supported by Hicks & Funson, Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000. Major support for WEKU comes from Kentucky's Touchstone Energy Cooperatives, serving members locally in Kentucky for decades. Co-ops exist to serve co-op members. Learn more about Kentucky's Touchstone Energy Cooperatives at togetherwesaveky.com. And now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Something special for the season is happening on Sunday, December 11th, a performance of Bach's Christmas Oratorio, a complex and beautiful masterpiece of the Baroque period, rarely heard between the coasts, but happening right here in Lexington at First Presbyterian Church. Here to tell us about it are Marlon Hurst, Artistic Director of the Kentucky Bach Choir, and Rick Dirksen, a longtime member of the bass section of the choir and a member of its board. He grew up, by the way, singing this repertoire in Washington, where his late father, Richard Wayne Dirksen, was the organist choir master at the National Cathedral. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. Glad to be here.
The music we'll be talking about is from the Baroque period. First, for our listeners, how do you define or characterize that particular period in history?
The Baroque period, in general terms, spans from about 1600 to 1750. Bach was born in 1685, so sort of right in the middle of it, and died in 1750, and it really is with Bach's death that marks the end of the Baroque period. The Baroque period started kind of as a backlash to the complexity of the music of the late Renaissance. Early Baroque music was simpler, more straightforward. And then as things go over time, over the next 150 years, and thanks in large part to Bach, the music became more and more complex. And so you see Bach reaching back to the early Baroque period for straightforward music, but also his complex polyphony, that's multi-part writing, harkens back to music of the late Renaissance. And so by the time the Baroque period wraps up, the early classical period that followed it is once again marked by a return to simplicity. So in a nutshell, in a very brief nutshell, that's sort of the trajectory of the music of the Baroque period.
Gotcha. Okay, so this performance coming up, you say, is unique in our area. Tell me more about that.
Most often we hear at this time of year from the Baroque period, we hear Handel's famous oratorio, Messiah. Handel's work was a concert work. It was not a liturgical work. And so it's meant to be dramatic with the choruses and the solos telling the story of the not just the birth of Jesus, but the entire life of Jesus. Most often we hear the Christmas portion, so-called Christmas portion, part one of Messiah during this time. Bach's oratorio is conceived differently. Bach was a church musician, and so Bach wrote cantatas for particular Sundays, and these were to proclaim the word, the musical proclamation of the word in a service, and usually began with a chorus and then a series of recitatives and arias with soloists that would tell the story and then wrap up with a chorale. So the Bach's Christmas oratorio is a collection of six cantatas that were not all meant to be performed at the same time. They were meant to be performed on successive Sundays. The first three that we're performing tell the Christmas story kind of in general terms around Luke chapter 2 from the Gospel of Luke chapter 2 that tells that Christmas story. And it's told with choruses, recitatives and arias, and chorales. And the chorales would have probably been, they were hymn tunes, would have probably been sung by the congregation as well as the choir.
Let's bring Rick Dirksen in here. Rick, if you would, tell us about Baroque instruments and how they and their pitch affect vocalists.
Yes, Tom, it's interesting. The instruments which Bach composed for in the 18th century were quite different from modern instruments in a number of regards. Stringed instruments, for example, usually had strings made from gut rather than metal and were played with different sized bows using different bowing techniques. Flutes were made of wood rather than metal, and other wind instruments like oboes and bassoons were shaped and fingered differently. And brass instruments likewise didn't have valves, such as today's trumpets do. Moreover, the tuning of these instruments was typically based upon a pitch level of A at 415 beats per minute, rather than 440 beats per minute, which is what we are used to here. That produces an overall pitch level approximately a half step lower. Taken together, these differences produced an overall sound of the orchestra, which was typically somewhat lighter and warmer than what we are used to. Now, for a vocal soloist, performing Bach's arias nowadays over a much brighter orchestral sound, the singer often has the sense of having to project over an orchestral accompaniment. By contrast, performing with early instruments, the singer often feels that the lighter and warmer texture makes it easier to hear the other parts, and so be more a part of a chamber ensemble, performing with rather than over the group. Now, ideally, the same is true for well-trained chorus, in which the lowered pitch helps the singers relax and blend with the instrumentalists rather than struggle to sing over the accompaniment. So particularly in more challenging passages, this lighter texture can help singers hear and maintain balance with the instruments and with one another.
So this is what your audience will experience. The musicians will be using authentic period instruments.
That's correct. And the sound that they will hear is rather different than what they're used to.
Well, let's listen to an example. That's a passage from Bach's Christmas Oratorio being performed on December 11th at First Presbyterian Church in Lexington. If you would tell us about the musicians who are going to be making their way from the East Coast to Lexington to perform. I guess that's a question for you, Marlon.
These Baroque wind players, it's sort of a niche. It's a niche. So we don't have a lot of folks who are local for that. Jason Doval, however, is the trumpet professor at the University of Kentucky, and he really specializes in Baroque trumpet. So he's cultivating, he has a Baroque trumpet group at the University of Kentucky. So all three of our trumpet players, Jason being the principal trumpet, are from here in the central Kentucky area. But when it comes to the oboes and the flutes, we have to go further afield. We have oboists coming in from Virginia, Illinois, and New York City. And we have two Baroque flautists coming in from Indiana, associated with the University of Indiana at Bloomington.
And you mentioned artists from UK. I understand there are also some connections to EKU and to Berea.
I actually had the good fortune to be a sabbatical fill-in for Dr. Richard Waters at EKU in spring of 2019 and made some relationships down there and recruited some of those singers to come sing in the choir. Dr. Jill Campbell, who's an assistant professor of choral conducting at EKU, is associate conductor of the Kentucky Bach Choir and a member of the soprano section. And we have three current or former students singing in the choir. And then the connection to Berea is Miguel Angel Bañales was a student of Mark Calkins, who is an associate professor of voice at Berea College. And Miguel is from Mexico City, and he came to Berea to study with Mark. And he is now a third-year master's degree student at the University of Colorado in Boulder.
All right, and once again, that's Sunday, December the 11th, a performance of Bach's Christmas Oratorio at First Presbyterian Church in Lexington. Marlon Hurst, Artistic Director of the Kentucky Bach Choir, and Rick Dirksen, a bassist in the choir, also a member of its board. Thank you both, and may you enjoy a wonderful performance.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you, Don.
Are you, at heart and in truth, an artist or an entrepreneur? Did fear of risk get in the way of realizing your dream? It's the question not just raised, but on trial in our latest Eastern Standard Radio play, United States vs. Fear, written by Patrick Mitchell and starring Patrick as Fear, Emmanuel Thurman as Hope, Letitia Williams-Priestley as the prosecutor, and Joe Farrell as the judge. Sound design by Neil Kesterson.
We are here for the case of the United States versus Fear. Fear is charged with several acts of murder. Murder dreams globally. It is also alleged that Fear benefited directly from these murders. Today, we will be dealing with the death of Hope's dream. You represent, work in conjunction with, and are tied to the core motivation of these murders, greed. What say you to these charges?
Innocent, Your Honor.
It is my understanding that you'll be defending yourself. Although it is your right to do so, I would be remiss in my duties as the presiding judge if I didn't warn you against that. He who defends himself is a fool for a client. Do you understand?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, that being said, is the prosecution ready?
Yes, we are, Your Honor. Your Honor, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, we plan to prove that Fear is guilty. Guilty of murder. Murdering dreams, hopes, and lives. The motivation for these murders? Greed. Fear has caused complacency, hopelessness, and ultimately, death. Fear has been successful at killing dreams through psychological warfare. Fear has several international businesses, including film production companies, art studios, banking institutions, technology and software corporations. And now we understand Fear has a hand in the food industry. Today, you'll be hearing the testimony of Hope. Hope will be telling of a dream destroyed as a direct result of situations caused by the defendant. Thank you.
Your Honor, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I do not deny owning businesses, businesses that are doing great. I do not deny wanting the better things in life, and I might go as far as to say I am guilty of being greedy. But there is a fine line between greed and success, and that in no way proves I'm a dream killer. I've never stabbed, shot, or strangled anyone's goals, wants, or desires. Fear, at its basis, is an evil used to control church, school, hell, even sex, and it is at the root of the pursuit of money, but it has nothing to do with me. The prosecutor will present Hope today to prove their case, but the fact that Hope is here proves I am innocent, for if Hope were in fear, would Hope be here? They are actually making my case for me. I provide options. People make choices. Thank you.
The state may present its first witness.
The state calls Hope. Can you state your name and address for the record, please?
Hope. I 411 Cerebral Court.
Now, for the record, could you tell the court where you work?
Yes, I am employed at Grow Corp. It's a subsidiary of Fair Inc.
And what do they do?
Our Grow Corp is at the center of the food industry. They supply food for most of the eastern region. Grocery stores, restaurants, and food wholesalers. Landowners with close to 1 million farm acres across the Midwest. They also own all but 2 theme restaurant chains.
And your position?
They were vice president in charge of regional marketing.
And how long have you been in this position?
5 years this March.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Now, I assume you have a degree in this field.
Well, actually, no. I have a BA in applied art and a master's in art history. I had aspirations of an art career.
Really? Selling or producing?
Oh, both, actually. I wanted my own gallery. A gallery where art dealers could display their clients' work and mine as well. In the back of the gallery, there would be a studio and a loft. Everything I needed in one location. And the gallery would pay for itself, and I would live off of what I earned. Studio in the sky. It would be in a Soho skyscraper. I had the building picked out and everything. It had a nice view of the city.
Sounds like a nice plan. What happened?
Well, after graduation, I decided to tour the country a bit and sketch. I took odd jobs here and there to support myself and my travels. I saved up and moved to Europe for a little while, hoping to get motivation to sketch that masterpiece, sell it, and use the money to get my gallery. But that didn't happen. So as the money ran out, eventually I moved back to my parents' house and stayed as long as I could before they drove me crazy. That's when I got a job at Grow Corp.
Mm-hmm. So what happened after that?
I had $130,000 in student loans. I had to work. I started out in billing. It wasn't what I wanted, but it paid well. I got a really nice apartment in a gated community on the south side of town. It wasn't too expensive, but comfortable.
Sounds like things were going well.
Things were going well. I had been in billing 6 months when the senior vice president in marketing heard that I had an education in art. He said that he was having problems with the marketing campaign and asked could I give it an artistic look. Well, I did and tweaked it a bit, and they liked it and used what I created. After that, they moved me into marketing with a higher pay and a title.
Really?
After a while, I decided to invest in a home. Of course, I eventually met someone, fell in love and got married, and then eventually had the 2.5 kids. It seemed the more I made, the more I spent. As the family got bigger, so did the bills. I now found myself investing in their future. I found myself thinking about their higher education.
I am happy for you. So now you are in this life, living the American dream, but you had this vision. What happened to the idea, the gallery, the studio in the sky?
Life.
Life? Not sure what you mean.
Well, I did try to become the artist that I wanted to be, but I never reached that level.
But life isn't over. You still have your eyes, your hands, and can probably still sketch. Why not still go for your dream?
In life. I mean, I have to work and pay bills and can't bank on art now.
Can't bank on art?
Art won't pay the bills.
So you never try it again?
Well, I pick up some charcoal from time to time, and I have a sketch pad with words.
Well,
and,
have you
tried
to take some time off to complete something? Have you tried to do something towards your dream at all?
I mean, yes, I tried.
Well, what happened? Did you make any plans?
Well, yes. I had an idea for a project. Something I knew was going to jumpstart.
Well, what happened?
Objection, Your Honor. Badgering the witness.
It's the state's witness.
I'm waiting.
Look, I'm sorry, but I'm not understanding the question.
Well, it is a relatively simple question, especially for someone with an education. Have you tried to live the dream you spoke so eloquently about? Did you even make any steps towards your studio in the sky? Did you even make...
An attempt. Is that what you were going to say? Did I make an attempt? I attempted to, but could never get off work. I would asked to take a vacation, but some huge account will come along and you don't want to pass that up. You don't want to pass up a challenge because it's a rush. It's another chance to create. They listened to me. They liked my ideas and they worked. I was still being an artist, but I could never get off work to do my project because work always got in the
way. Must have been difficult.
And you have no idea. Having this passion burning inside, but you can't feed the flame because a client needs a sketch. Did you know that you have a yearly vacation limit? And if you don't use a certain amount, you lose it?
Yes, I did know.
Objection, Your Honor. Is that prosecutor going anywhere with this?
Calm yourself.
I missed so many vacations. I almost lost my family.
Your Honor, where are we going?
I am going to tell you one last time. Calm.
I missed so many vacations. I almost lost my family.
Can we wrap this up?
One last question. Why didn't you go for your dream?
Because fear wouldn't give me time to do it. Fear kept me working. Fear needed me. Fear kept the income steady, the bonuses hefty, and I lost focus on that dream. It died, and when I finally found motivation, fear wouldn't give me room to breathe. I was afraid to lose what I had.
Thank you. The prosecution rests.
Your witness.
Hope, is it? You mentioned that after school, you traveled the country and then took off to Europe to sketch. Is that right?
Yes.
And then you returned home to live with Mommy and Daddy. Is that right?
Yes.
They got on your nerves, so you got a job with Grocar, which I happen to own.
Yes, and
Now, if I understand the order of things correctly, you finished school, traveled the country, went to Europe, got contacted by the government for their money back, went home, got a job with us, and were making pretty good money, got a promotion working in the field that you're educated in, took some of that money and invested in a home, and now your kid's future. Is that right?
I mean, yes.
Well, I'm just wondering, where is my part in the death of your dream? Well, let me ask you this. How long were you out there in the world?
Excuse me?
How long after school were you seeking this masterpiece? How long before you came home?
3 years.
Well, how many books did you make? I mean, you spent all that time and did all those drawings, which I'm sure are great, so they must be hanging in a gallery somewhere. Well, how many books did you make?
None.
Well, what happened to all that work?
I didn't finish because...
I mean, we're talking 3 years.
I didn't finish.
We don't have a hint of any of this to be able to hang on our walls.
Objection, Your Honor. The defendant is not allowing the witness
to... So where are these masterpieces?
I threw them away.
Excuse me?
I threw them away.
And why would you do that?
Because... I have to be honest, I didn't think anyone would like them. I just didn't want to hear that they were no good. I figured that it would be easier just to get rid of them.
Less painful.
Yes.
So you got rid of them?
When I moved back home. I just figured it was a waste of time to continue. I figured maybe I could teach.
Yeah, I understand. It was easier to fall into another career, one without criticism about what you love, what you're passionate about. Fuel the fire of others, collect a check, and be somewhat safe.
Yeah, I guess.
I hear you. But I beg to differ. See, I have seen your work, and I contend that you are a great artist. So much so that not only did you get promoted as a result of your talent, but you have made the company several $1 million. You've gotten bonuses and offers from several other companies. You see, you are good and just needed to hear it, to be challenged and left alone to rise to that occasion. Now you chose to walk away from your dream, chose to discard those world sketches and go back home to the safety of your parents because of obligations. So with that in mind, I have one final question.
Yes.
What in the hell does any of this have to do with me? I am being accused of killing dreams, of crushing spirits and destroying lives. In my defense, I say to you, it is not me, but the people who have those dreams chose to abandon them. As Hope mentioned, when times got hard, Hope went where it was safe. The idea of the studio in the sky fell apart because Hope never tried. The reality was Hope was good, but gave up. I contend once again that Hope may never have been the business person that Hope dreamt, but did live the life of an artist. Fear offers options. People make the choice. Thank you.
Yes, people make a choice. Sometimes they are forced into those choices because of their options being limited. Limited to their reach, controlled by fear. A woman wants a man to like her so badly. She does whatever it takes to keep him. Hope had a dream, but fear caused Hope to abandon it because of need. Fear pulled up Hope into its web of needs and made Hope a slave to Goldcorp for fear's own personal gain. Fear Inc. has yearly earnings of over $1 billion. They actually own Pearl Studios, which is the largest chain of art galleries and antiquities in the world. But instead of helping Hope to live that dream, the proverbial carrot of income dangled in front of Hope, like a worm to a fish, making Hope hungry for more and making fear millions. Wanting in excess is the epitome of greed. I think we have proven that greed caused the death of Hope's dream. We ask that you find fear guilty of that death. And let's put an end to this dream serial killer. Thank you.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, it is now up to you to decide fear's fate. Whatever decision that is derived must be a unanimous one. And if you have any questions about the charges, are confused in any way, the bailiff will be close and is summoned to immediately make us aware of any concerns. You are now to be dismissed to deliberate.
The U.S. versus Fear by Patrick Mitchell, starring Mitchell in the role of Fear, Emmanuel Thurman as Hope, Letitia Williams-Priestley as the prosecutor, and Joe Farrell as the judge, with sound design by Neil Kesterson. You can listen online at esweku.org. Just click on the tab Radio Plays. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer. Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard Archive, our series, our partners, and more. And you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter featuring a preview of the coming edition. You can find us on the WEKU app, on NPR One, and on the Google News app. And if you'd like to call something to our attention or suggest a topic, our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.